The Southern California Linux Expo proudly presents Alex Perry.
Where you can't have a distribution really do package management for you the way you expect in a desktop or a server environment, somebody else gets to do the work. At the one extreme where you're building an embedded device from scratch, you get to do everything. You build the code and you make all the changes necessary to make it play nice with all the other code you're building. It's a huge amount of work. You're bound to make mistakes. And unless you're doing a very small number of pieces of software, you're going to have a heartache trying to make everything play nice together at the same time. But the advantage is, because you're doing it all yourself, you can throw away all those little features that the software provides that you don't need. And if you're in a really cost-sensitive, speed-sensitive environment, it's worth that effort. But you've got to go into it deciding that you're willing to pay the price to do that. And for most applications, you don't really need that, or you're only going to do that as a last resort. A lot of the embedded distributions simply provide you with a makefile. A makefile is all you need to tie everything together so that when the person says he'd like to have the system built, all the right things happen. The disadvantage of a makefile is that it's very hard to code assumptions into a makefile in a way that they're easily changed. So the makefile tends to provide you with a relatively rigid build environment. By way of reference, if you read the documentation on a makefile, you'll find out there's lots of things you cannot describe within a makefile and you have to do outside it. With that as a constraint, every time you have something you can't describe in a makefile, you have to make that something which is fixed for that whole possibility of that distribution. And then going towards a desktop environment, you can go with things like embedded Debian and the familiar approach to doing packaging and stuff like that, where you're trying to add a little bit of packaging in, just enough to make it work, but not quite enough to make it overwhelming. But at each of these three levels, the thing you have to remember is what you've lost is the stability, that predictability of the desktop server environment. What that means is when you build an embedded device, you're going to have to test it. You can't assume that somebody else has already tested your configuration for you. With that in mind, bear in mind, to the extent you're getting testing from somebody else put a lot of work in. And there's really three reasons why people do embedded distributions. And the first one is that they actually have two products. The first one is the embedded Linux distribution, and the second one is something else. While they're not losing money on the embedded Linux distribution, it's not really where they see their core focus. Linux works, for example, with a spelling change when they started doing Linux, has the approach that they have a non-Linux operating system, which a lot of people need, and they provide Linux to make it easy for people to move between Linux and non-Linux, where they have applications that sometimes need one and sometimes need the other. That is actually a useful feature, and they have a real market space where people are developing software that might need the hard real-time features of Linksys, and therefore will work with Lucat to make sure that they have a painless migration in the future if they need it. A second way of doing it is that if somebody has built a product, and in order to get that product working, they had to build their own embedded distribution, then the one thing they want to do is to avoid having to maintain it afterwards. So what they do is they make it an open source project to have this embedded distribution, and they're desperately trying to sign you on to be one of the developers. Now, the nice thing about that is that if it's kind of what you want, then you're accumulating some code which you can make use of. The disadvantage is that you've really got to look at the work they did to decide whether it's up to your quality standards. And similarly, you've got to look at how much work they're planning to do on this in future, because if they're happy with it the way it is right now, then yes, it's very nice to get an embedded distribution, but from now on, you're doing all the work. The third popular way of creating an embedded distribution is a form of corporate advertising. If you're a consultancy and you would like to have people come and bring you consulting work, building an embedded distribution that demonstrates how cleanly and effectively you can do embedded work encourages people to come and give you more work. That's where UC Linux originally came from, for example. So when you see embedded distributions, it's always very interesting to think about which of these three are they really trying to do? Where is it their motive to get involved? Finally, when you talk about motive, companies are trying to make money. Behind the motive somewhere is a business strategy. And it's very important to understand when you're talking to them that they might be providing you software for free, but there is a profit strategy in there. And if you don't understand it, you may fall foul of it. Not from the point of view of giving them lots of money, but then ending up in a situation where the level of support you get doesn't correspond to the amount that you were expecting or hoping to pay for. Licensing, therefore, is a key factor in bringing code in-house. whether it's an embedded Linux distribution or any application. The projects you're working on, especially products that are going to be handheld and the like, they have a business plan for how they're going to make money and sell a large number of them. It's very embarrassing if the licensing that you accidentally signed up for by bringing code in is licensing which makes your business model for that product impossible. So if the project has a business model in mind already, somebody knows what that is and is in a position to decide whether a given license is going to hurt it. It's very important for that person to think about the licenses that you're choosing and tell you whether those licenses are acceptable to the project. It's purely a business decision. It's not an engineering decision at all. Legal support is usually a good idea for the business people, if they're not lawyers themselves, in order to actually understand the implications of a license. That doesn't mean engineering can just say, I'd like to use this software, use this license, tell me whether I can or not, because that doesn't work either. Engineering is actually having to communicate to describe in what way the licenses might interact. Are you planning to make changes to the code? Are you planning to link it to the code? Is the code going to have a feature added which you cannot disclose if the license is one which requires disclosure? Just giving the license to business people and telling them, tell me whether I can use this or not, is not sufficient. They need to know what your plans are for working with that code. And if you don't do that, you're liable to end up with some of the more public cases where you've seen people develop products, put them out there, and then the developers of the product end up the result, under lawsuit because they didn't understand the licenses they'd agreed to. Next thing to remember is that you're looking at an embedded distribution at an instant. You might take several weeks to study it, but over the years of lifespan of a distribution and of your product as it goes into support, that really isn't very long. It's very hard to get a feel for the ongoing development of a distribution. General purpose distributions, desktop distributions, change very fast. Some of them change faster than others. Backward compatibility is often not really a factor if you go from one general purpose distribution to the next. The fact that code doesn't work anymore is, on some distributions, embedded and otherwise, considered your problem, not theirs. That would then mean that you'd have to change your code every year. But then again, if your product's not ever going to get changed after a year, that doesn't really hurt you, does it? Specialist distributions, like ones designed for doing networking devices, they don't tend not to change. Once the people who are currently working on them are happy, they're not going to change anymore. That's fine if they already do what you want and you're just adding features. But you shouldn't then look at those and assume that they're going somewhere and next year there are going to be a whole load more features than there are now. There may not be. So between those two, where things are changing faster than you'd like and the bit where they're changing slower than you like, is the happy medium where you have a distribution which does what you want. But there is no correct speed for development of a distribution because it comes down to the product as to how fast a specific project wants that distribution to be moving. So there is no correct answer. All you can do is look at what everybody else is doing and decide whether you like it and whether it's appropriate for you. And it's hard to judge at short notice. Like I say, it's a good idea to look at history, keep logs, check mailing lists to get some idea of where these things are really moving. So once you're working with an embedded distribution, whether one you're building yourself, one you bought in, or one you've downloaded, you need to remember there's really four sections to working with an embedded device. The first thing is the bootloader. A bootloader generally comes with the device you buy, or if you're working from a raw chip, from the toolkit that you've downloaded. That bootloader says what you can and cannot do with those chips. It's easy to say the bootloader doesn't matter as soon as Linux is booted, but it's not true in two ways. One of which is you'll be seeing the bootloader a whole lot during development. And the other one is the bootloader makes assumptions about the peripherals you've got plugged in. If the bootloader doesn't understand partitions, then your flash chip cannot be partitioned. And as soon as you cannot partition the flash chip, it makes it very difficult to put nice file systems on there, like a JFFS2 next to a CRAMFS, in order to get the performance you need, because the bootloader doesn't understand it. So it's very important when you're choosing chips and you're choosing boards that you can buy from people that have the bootloader built in, that you check exactly what the bootloader can and cannot do, because that's going to tell you what you can and cannot do in many ways thereafter. The second thing that you get in a embedded device is a custom configured Linux kernel. The key thing about that custom configured kernel is it has to boot. Until the kernel boots, you're arguing with the kernel about trying to make the peripherals work. Making the peripherals work is easy, relatively, once the kernel's running and you can use all the user space tools for debugging. It's much harder when half the kernel services aren't running yet. So the custom config kernel, you often will get one with a board that you buy, but it may not have the features you need. That custom configured kernel is the first step to booting the system up. Once it gets to the point where the kernel has realized it doesn't have a file system yet, most of the work is done. But getting to that point can be difficult if you have non-standard peripherals. Separately to that, there's the peripherals needed for the application. None of those are really necessarily needed to boot. If you've got a video capture card, you don't need a video capture card to boot Linux. But if your application is a video camera, then a capture card is essential to make the product ship. And the third group is distinct from the second group because to develop the third group, you can treat the embedded device like a normal desktop system. And all the techniques you've learned to develop drivers in normal servers and desktops are applicable at this point. And the fourth part is a file system. The user space file system, which of course includes modules from the third category, that user space file system is where the smarts go that make it into an embedded product that people can understand and use, that has a user interface and makes sense. Now, looking at the bootloader, in addition to the downside of having one that doesn't understand about partitions and similar constraints on you as a developer, some bootloaders have the ability to network booting. Now, it's embarrassing to ship a product out to customers with the network booting still turned on without telling them, because then they plug it into a managed network, it'll stop working. But a bootloading device is very useful for development because it means you can stop using the flash. To use the flash, you actually have to build the flash image and then take the time to transfer it to the device, wait while the device burns it to flash, then reboot the device and have it read the flash. That takes quite a while, especially because flash programming cycles are quite slow. If you've got a network bootable device, then you can boot the device as fast as you can transfer the image across the network. And that can be fractions of a second. People tend to refer to the x86 version of this as a diskless boot. It's tempting to call it flashless on the embedded device, but of course the flash chip is still there, and the bootloader is stored in flash, so you can't actually call it flashless. But you can call it network boot if you want. The key thing to remember is that it's not just the fact that you're having to send the stuff over the network, it's also the fact that you can sit on your development workstation and tell it to reboot the system and try the new version of a kernel or a driver, and probably within 3 seconds watch it run. So you can iterate trying new versions of a driver and trying to fix a bug, where reboots are happening every 5 or 10 seconds. That's certainly not feasible if you're programming a flash chip every time. And by the way, it's also not feasible on x86, especially those nice people who provide us the SCSI drivers that spend 5 minutes looking for the disk drives. So I'm going to give a quick kernel overview at this point. I'm not talking about the kernel from the point of view of programming for it. I'm talking about it from the point of view of being an embedded device. Kernel programming on an embedded device is no different from kernel programming on a desktop or a server. The biggest advantage you get is that it's simple, there's less in it, and you have a faster boot. But the Linux kernel is a Linux kernel. That's why you're using it, remember. You're wanting something that's portable. The kernel is the only program that's running as far as the hardware is concerned. Everything else is just something which the kernel deigns to have happen temporarily. It enforces access control, it enforces device access, and it's generally the place where device drivers run. There are some things where people just expose the device through to user space pokes around at the device directly, but that's generally discouraged. So in most cases, the Linux kernel is the actual program that's controlling the system. It virtualizes memory, and it virtualizes memory for two reasons. In addition to security, you're trying to make address reuse possible so that you can run two copies of the same program. But memory is also virtualized to allow you to cache various things, mostly file system access. File system access is a very good thing, especially on flash drives where write cycles are slow and read cycles are very fast. If you're on a desktop system, you may have noticed that even if you have a huge amount of memory, the system is swapping programs out to disk, and you can watch the swap actually get used within a few hours of starting a system. You might have a gigabyte of memory, but there's still stuff out in swap. And the reason is that your kernel has realized that there's a program which hasn't done anything for an hour, and it's a bit of a waste of memory keeping it hanging around if it's not being used. So let's move that program out to the disk and use that memory as disk cache. Non-network devices turn up as special files, and as a result, you have the permissions layer. The nice thing about most device drivers is they're written cleanly to be portable. If your little embedded peripheral has a PCI bus, for example, or can emulate a PCI bus, then pretty much any device which implements PCI can be embedded onto your peripheral and will work. Most PCI drivers are written to be portable. There are certain exceptions. And if you're running with a little ARM processor, a quick way of finding out that you're going to have trouble with a given device driver is even before you've bought it, if you check on the mailing lists and all the people with PowerPCs complain that it crashes. At that point, the driver probably needs some Endian work. But if you can see that the driver already works on x86, IA64, PowerPC quite comfortably, then it's likely that you can use the same chip on your embedded design and it'll work out of the box. Network devices are completely different from non-network devices. They go directly into the networking stack. You don't do access control using files. There's a different security layer for the network. The nice thing about Linux is the networking protocols are built into the kernel. They're not a user space service. They're not a library. What that means is that if you're trying to have something happen, the networking layer is actually the most efficient way to communicate. You make your request for communication to the kernel, and thereafter, until that request is completed, it's the kernel's problem. You're not watching context switches between the kernel and user space to try and complete your request. That means that on low-end devices like microcontrollers, networking is a very efficient way to communicate. Much more efficient, for example, than just trying to use a serial port or something, because a serial port, you generate interrupts, and those all have to go to user space, and it slows things down. There are lots of advantages to having lots of network interfaces that you'll notice on server farms and the like. On embedded devices, it's useful to have multiple interfaces because it lets you do security layers and things very easily. Another thing to bear in mind is that you end up with two reasons to have modules in your kernel. The first one is because if you've got a module that doesn't work very well, you're still debugging it. You don't want to have that kernel module be one that loads at startup, causing your machine to crash before you've even debugged anything. So you'd like to have it be something which loads later on. The system boots, you know everything's stable, everything's working great, load the module, it crashes. It's very easy to debug what's happening at that point. The other reason to end up having modules in your system is if you have modules which you're buying in whose licensing is not GPL, or modules you're writing yourself that you cannot disclose how they work. So you can have modules that taint the kernel that aren't GPL, that's not a problem. The thing you have to bear in mind is it's very dangerous to design those into your project, because one of the side effects of not being a GPL license is normally that they don't give you portable source code. You're immediately constrained to using the binaries they provide for the kernel versions that they support. And even if you talk them into, for example, providing you with an ARM binary for your project right now, if you find out in 6 months' time you have to redesign it for a PowerPC, if they won't give you a PowerPC binary, your project has just died. So closed source drivers, they're bad enough on the desktop and on servers, but they're absolutely critical to the death of an awful lot of embedded projects. The other nice thing about device drivers is the fact that embedded devices these days are coming with USB ports. They didn't used to, but it's increasingly becoming the case that USB is routinely being provided. Nice thing about USB on the desktop and why people like it is you don't have to open the case to attach hardware. And that's the real reason people say it's great. You don't have to open the case. That's not quite the reason why embedded people like it. The thing you have to understand about USB is that unlike most other peripherals that you attach to a Linux system, it's actually very efficient in its use of the processor. By having the processor describe in memory what it'd like to have happen, point the chip at that memory and leave it to it, getting the occasional interrupt back to tell it how it's getting on, you can ask for an awful lot of I/O to happen to a lot of different peripherals over on the USB bus and only get back one interrupt or a few interrupts telling you how it's getting on. Whereas, for example, if you wanted a serial port, you might get an interrupt every few characters. With USB, you might get an interrupt every kilobyte or two. There's a huge difference in the interrupt load, and interrupts are very expensive. A final thing to bear in mind is that if you have a USB 2.0 controller, the nice thing about it is you get more bandwidth. Two things change. First of all, the bus cycles at 8 kilohertz rather than 1 kilohertz, which means that you can end up having 8 times more interrupts very easily. You have the performance that goes with it, but the downside is you're being hit with all those extra interrupts. If you've got an interrupt-sensitive machine, you may want to consider running a 2.0 interface as just 1.1 in order to avoid this problem. The other reason why embedded people like USB is not because they don't have to open the case. It's because On an embedded machine, you can't open the case and have a PCI slot in there. Embedded things, that you have what's on the board. There is nothing more you can add. Nice thing about USB is if you have even one USB wire pair coming off your embedded device, you can add anything you like. Now, when the end user is using the product, he may be happy with the feature set that is on the board. But when you as a developer are trying to debug things, then the one thing you'd like to have is interfaces to talk to it that are not the ones the user sees. That way, you can talk to the software separately from pretending to be the user. And so you start looking at all the different things you can hang on a USB bus and realize that adding a hard drive to have temporarily more storage than 16 megabytes sounds like heaven. Having a printer port just so that you can log something without watching it scroll up the screen on your terminal. Adding a network interface so you can distinguish your NFS access from, for example, the router traffic that your device is trying to handle. Or even just a serial port that's faster than 100 kilobaud. There are lots of different ways to use USB to speed up your device. The final thing is, when you start looking at these devices and you're trying to use them on your embedded target, do use them on your desktop system first. If you plug a device in your desktop system and it doesn't work, it saves a lot of worrying about why it didn't work when you plug it into the target. I'm amazed at how many people go out and buy a dongle and their first thing they do is plug it into the target and because they, for some reason, assumed everything worked under Linux. Finally, while I said that all embedded devices have USB these days, what I really meant was on almost all US embedded devices, you can add USB if you try hard enough. Most USB devices, most embedded devices these days have an expansion capability. And between PCI and the mini and card variants and ISA and various other buses that are available, you can usually find a USB adapter somehow to bolt on. And what I'm recommending is it's usually easier to bolt on one device driver for the USB and then put everything else through that than to try and do little additional drivers as you go along to support development. I wanted to mention that the kernels are available for download. It's an obvious point to make for the people who know it. For the people who don't know it, they tend to work on the assumption that the kernel you've got, the embedded distribution, is the one you have to use, especially if you're used to the closed source embedded development environments where that's true, that the only kernel you can use is the one that you received. In open source, you received a kernel. It's the one they recommend. Does that mean you should use a different one? No, not really. But the interesting thing is to go off and find out what the standard version of that kernel is and find out what they had to change. What they had to change to make it work can be considered by you as a hint as to the things it's best not messed with. One of the reasons people pick Linux is for scalability. You can run it on big computers and small computers, and there's lots of people who know how to use it. But another reason people pick it for embedded stuff is that it's supported on so many different processors. Not so much the higher-end ones, although you do embedded systems using high-end processors, but especially down at the low end, there's a lot of broad processor support. The value there is the fact that because everything's written in C, and the user space code can be simply recompiled, it's very easy to move a product from one to another. This is very important. At any given time, chips are being released from the many major manufacturers at a new chip every week or so. And if you design a product around one chip, and then a month later a different chip comes out that has the same feature set, costs less, and is lower power, anybody starting a project at that point will beat you in the market because they'll have longer battery life. It'll look nice. It might have a color screen for the same cost of goods as you're working with. If you can't then just quickly take your project and redirect it to that new chip with essentially no notice, then you've just locked yourself into being a previous generation design. So the platform ability is a big benefit. It allows you to switch between chips to try and get the one that you like. Of course, you can see this going the other way around. You go out and you buy peripherals, and the last version of this one worked for Linux. This one doesn't. That manufacturer obviously took the same advantage and made a sneaking change. So do try and keep your code portable, even if you're not actually planning to change architectures. If you have to hard code something, provide a fast path that works on this architecture and a slow path that will work on an x86, for example, and then you know you can move any time you need to. The other recommendation is that you always compile for more than one architecture. If you're building for an ARM, build for your x86 desktop. If your embedded target is x86, go and get yourself a PowerPC-based desktop machine and compile for that too. It's surprising how many bugs of the kind that will kill an embedded system are only really apparent when you build for more than one architecture. A lot of bugs like memory leaks and things like that don't necessarily cause you trouble in a desktop environment. You've got lots of memory and lots of spare performance. But as you constrain the performance of a machine so that it's really running at the limit of its capabilities, even the smallest little infelicity in your code can take the machine out. And if it's going to take it out after 2 hours of running, you're going to spend a lot of time waiting 2 hours to see whether it crashes. If it only crashes after 30 minutes, if you change the architecture, never mind why. That saves you a factor of four in how long it's going to take you to fix that bug. So I said before, you've got the bootloader and the kernel and the additional set of drivers. Once you've got that working to the point that it boots, at this point you still haven't needed a file system, really, because you can load drivers using an initial RAM disk. That initial RAM disk you can transfer over the network if your bootloader supports it. So until this point, we haven't necessarily even needed to use the flash. You've got a very fast development cycle. Once you've got the kernel and the modules working, so the system is coming up, and now you'd like to do something useful with it, you can put all of that in flash. I recommend that you do so. I also recommend that you get a stopwatch out and time how fast it takes to boot from flash compared to booting over the network. On quite a few targets, it's surprising that it's actually still faster to boot over the network. It might only be 2 seconds. But that's 2 seconds times every time you press the reset switch. And if you've gotten a regression tester where the computer you're sitting at actually presses the reset switch to do regression testing and is going to reboot it a few thousand times overnight for you, those 2 seconds mount up very fast. You can save yourself a man week by the end of the project just by shaving 2 seconds off the reboot time on your test cycle. And it's not like it's much effort for you. You were already doing a network boot anyway, so you just carry on doing it that way. Sharing the file system, the usual way of doing it is use NFS root and make the file system available to the target and the host. That makes it easy to make changes. The latencies associated with NFS root are, of course, different from the latencies on a file system that's on the flash. Does that mean you have to put it on a flash to make sure everything works and take that cost? Well, not necessarily. You just have to make the latencies different over the NFS. So if you have it so it's really fast, you can try making it slow and see how it works. Do bear in mind that one of the nice things about using an NFS root compared to the embedded flash is that when your Linux system is using the flash, it has to read things from the flash to run it, which is as slow as your flash device. If it's reading things over the NFS, then it's as fast as your network device, because remember, you booted this machine 10 seconds ago. Therefore, everything that the NFS needs is already in your RAM cache on your workstation, because the workstation didn't get rebooted. Everything you need is already there. So anything you want to do with the NFS for testing is just a network transfer out of the memory of your workstation. That's why the NFS is such a fast test environment. The downside of that is that advantage of speed means it runs faster and slightly better than when it's running out of flash. You do still have to worry about that. I'm going to mention UC Linux, the microcontroller version here. I've mentioned it by name previously. The advantage of UC Linux is it lets you write code to run on those really little microcontrollers that don't have memory management and are probably originally intended to run little standalone PDAs or industrial controllers and stuff. As a side effect of being that small, that they don't have memory management, they normally also don't have floating point, and their speed for interrupts and the like is so slow that you can essentially hang one of them by plugging it into a high-speed network if you don't do your networking stack correctly. Just the time it takes to respond to a network packet, find out the network packet's address to the microcontroller, decide it isn't, and throw it away. On a normal network, that happens sufficiently often, especially if it's got Windows machines around that don't have their name lookups configured right. You can actually just plug the machine into the network, and it boots up as far as starting the network interface and then stops. It just can't get any further. It's processing network packets continuously. That doesn't mean that's the only thing you can do. You can work around that, but often the default on the slower machines just floods the machine. The next thing to bear in mind is that people tell you how marvelous the real-time extensions are for Linux that provide you with greatly reduced latency. When you attach those real-time extensions to UC Linux, you get the same improvement in latency, which gets you back to the point you probably were on the machine you're using on your desktop without the real-time extensions. It sort of cancels. The machine is that much slower, the real-time extensions reduce the latency by that much. What you end up with is a machine which performs as badly as a desktop machine does. Having said that, it's a much cheaper processor, so it's a good thing. But don't think of the real-time extensions as giving you some magic thing that gets you beyond where a desktop is. It doesn't. The other thing that UC Linux does is, because you don't have memory management, some system calls don't work. You inherently cannot fork a process to give you two copies running in what pretends to be the same address space, because you can't manage the memory to make that happen. So fork's impossible. Vfork works, but one of the fun things is a lot of people have written code for the desktop where on the desktop the two calls are equivalent. And so they've used fork. So you have to go through all the code and change all the forks to vforks and make sure that vfork is actually relevant, because it does not do the same thing in a desktop environment. So there's lots of ways in which actually you cannot routinely move code from the desktop to UC Linux. But having said that, remember the point isn't to expect to do that. You can't seriously expect code that somebody wrote to run on a gigahertz processor, to run on a processor whose speed is measured in megahertz, and expect it to work out of the box. The runtime environments are too different. You can write code that'll run in both, but what you're really doing is writing code that'll run on a microcontroller in UC Linux, which if you compile on a desktop machine will also run. This is not a method of moving code from a desktop to a microcontroller. It's a method to write code on a microcontroller, which you can move the other way. Is that valuable? It's incredibly valuable. You can sell a little $30 widget that does something running in Linux. And if somebody comes along and says, I would like to have the 100 times faster version of this, and I'll pay you $100,000 to provide me with 10, it's very easy. You give them an x86 box with a program on it, and it will work. You don't have to write anything, and you pocket the $100,000. Just make sure it's a fixed price contract. You do not want time and materials for that one. There's a lot of processors that are supported by UC Linux. They're all different. Some of them are supported better, some of them are supported worse. Be very sure that when you go this way, that it will do what you want. You have very little room to maneuver because the machines are so slow. This is no different from doing any other programming. But it's very easy to have people who use Linux saying, oh, of course it can do that, because it's so trivial on a desktop machine. While the people who are used to embedded programming in assembly are looking at them going, well, I'm not too sure, you've got all that Linux overhead. Probably the other guy is right. On the slower ones in this architecture, for example, if you type ls, you hit enter and there's a pause, because by default ls sorts the list of file names. And there's a pause while the processor is sorting the list of file names, so it can print you the sorted list. On a microcontroller, it's faster to type ls with that little command and option that says don't sort the list, because it speeds things up. Also, you can actually see the individual printf calls happening. The cursor goes across, and you can see the little pauses that occur between the names. It's amazing how often you'll type a command and regret typing it, because it takes 3 seconds to run. You thought it was instantaneous, but actually, on these machines, it takes seconds. So it's a good thing, but don't imagine it to be something that it isn't. Now, I'd like to go into another topic here, which is that modular applications. Historically, people built modular applications for server farms where they wanted to move the PHP on one machine, put the database cluster on another set of machines, and just have one machine do one thing really well, and by using several hundred machines, get a lot of performance. And so this kind of software was scalable and had lots of layers to it. When people went towards embedded, where you had a PDA, it was only ever going to do one thing at once, it was considered stupid to have modular software because it's only going to do one thing at once. So you bolt everything into one program. So the embedded versions are often monolithic to things which, on a desktop environment, you might do in two or three layers. This is changing now, and it's worth keeping an eye on this paradigm shift, because as embedded devices, what we think of as embedded devices, like PDAs and the like, are starting to become always-on devices that are routinely talking to other PDAs on the internet, you're starting to get to the point where those PDAs are running an environment that looks like a data center. I'm not saying the compute load they're running at is the same as a data center. What I'm saying is the compute load they're running divided by the processor speed is starting to look suspiciously like a data center. And the architectural advantages of you running multiple processors, network connections to other machines and stuff like that, start starting to become relevant because you have that connectivity. Without the connectivity, you never had a choice. But do bear in mind that a PDA is not running a managed network. You don't have admins going around making sure people are on different IP addresses. Different IP addresses is a good thing. And it's amazing how many home networks that isn't happened. So when I refer to modular applications, this isn't an operating system feature or anything you do in the kernel. It's just choosing which software you use. Programs like the NameDaemon, Bind, most people use Bind, but there's actually about a dozen different standard ways of doing name resolution out there. You don't have to use Bind, you pick one of the other ones. You need to think through what you're trying to achieve and choose the software for your purpose. So from the point of view of the breakdown, I'm going to give you a quick run through of 10 steps of how the breakdown happens. Some of them you'll recognize. If you've got an application that's user interactive, on the desktop you'd pick OpenOffice, but you tend not to run OpenOffice on embedded platforms. Now, that doesn't mean you don't want to run something as complicated as OpenOffice on an embedded platform. What it means is that it had better be running somewhere else. The second thing you want is a nice, friendly program which takes all the different programs you're running, consolidates all their graphics input, output, and provides you with one consistent bitmap to show on the screen. x386 is popular, and is probably going to be popular for a short while in the future. But there's other ways of doing it, and there's other GUI toolkits that you use in association with them. But what's important is to remember somebody somewhere is responsible for consolidating programs together. Separately to that, you normally have a window manager. As you go embedded, 3 and 2 start to merge together into one toolkit. But it's worth thinking of them separately because you have the option of separating them even in the embedded environment. Some people like to run desktop managers on their machines, presumably in order to provide them with icons to remind them of the files that they have. But whether or not you run one, you end up with programs that are not really programs. They're metaprograms that are associated with the rest of the environment, navigation tools, pop-ups that keep track of what programs you're running and stuff like that. These are essential to the user. Whether it's called a desktop manager or the icon you click and it gives you a PS listing, you will have stuff like that around. And if it's there, you have to assume that people will use it, and therefore it might be running at the same time. 5 is the only thing which actually has to be on the machine you're sitting at. You need device drivers for the PDA to draw on the screen to communicate with the network to find out what that copy of OpenOffice that you left on your desktop is actually doing right now. Those device drivers have to be local. And because we're talking about Linux, you need a copy of Linux to go with them. But you don't actually need anything else. The choice to provide other things locally is primarily there to allow the device to operate disconnected. The next thing you have to remember is the stuff that everybody forgets about on the desktop. You do have network-related infrastructure. You need to be able to resolve domain names. People expect the device to know what the time is. If it's sending email and it's a connected device, it has to have some sensible way of doing that. These are all features which are normal in a network. In a desktop environment, they're just built in. In a corporate environment, there's a computer somewhere whose job it is to do this. When you're a PDA, you have to decide how are you going to handle this. In the worst case, it's your problem. Now, there's transient things which happen. When the user says, for example, he'd like to print, that print job will be coming local. But pretty much anything the user tries to do, you can end up starting up temporary programs. The key point here is that those temporary programs would like resources which actually you would rather have used for something else. So the point of a printing program is not really allocating resources for the printing program, but it's getting the resources back from all the other programs which said, quick, there's a megabyte of memory, let me use that. And explaining to those programs, you need that memory back. Because remember, on these embedded devices, you generally don't have swap. You can't just say, oh, that's all right, they'll get swapped out while I do this. Because the next thought will be, oh, that's right, I don't have swap. So category 8 is trying to find additional storage. Now remember I said your embedded device is 16 megabytes of flash. In order to do some word processing, the user has probably plugged in his little flash drive. And if it's like the ones you buy now, it's a gigabyte-sized flash drive. Probably costs more than the PDA he's using. So do you think he's going to notice if you store a few megabytes of stuff temporarily on that, USB flash drive because you're a bit short of memory? Because you only got 32 megs of RAM and 16 megs of flash? He probably won't notice. Just make sure it's stuff that you don't mind losing if he unplugs the drive before you get it back again. One tempting thing to do is, if the user has a file on there he's using and the file is open, then you can allocate a storage area on his flash drive, use that storage area for swap, and providing you only store stuff in that swap associated with the file, then if he unplugs it and he loses the file, then the fact that you lost the swap is the least of your worries. The other thing to bear in mind is that embedded devices these days routinely come with multiple processors. Sometimes it's referred to as, this processor here is the real one, honest, and this one over here is a DSP, and that one's a different kind of DSP. They're not really processors, they're video accelerators or modems or wireless access card chips, but they're all processors. historically, they were all special purpose cores. And the side effect of that was you'd throw some binary image into there and never really understood what happened. Increasingly, those cores are becoming standard cores. Right now, you can go out and try and order samples for multi-core ARM chips. They're coming out at the same time as Intel and AMD are doing all their multi-core stuff. It's happening just as fast as the embedded world. And the nice thing about those is you can go SMP. And more interestingly, you can go NUMA between if you need more processing power than that. Why is that important? Because all the features which they put into the data center to make Linux work in that environment are still there. You've generally assumed you just turn it off. I'm not going to have SMP on my little PDA. But you might. And the reason why you might is the fact it's lower power to use two processors to do the job at half the speed than one processor going at full speed, providing you can thread enough. Because remember, you can turn one of those processors off when you're not using it. So purely the driver power management is absolutely segmenting things into lots of little processors. And you can expect that you can take advantage of that. Your current product, as in the chip you're currently designing for, may not be SMP. But if you don't write clean code, then even when an SMP chip comes along, you won't be able to use that SMP chip because your drivers won't be SMP clean. SMP code disappears when you compile the kernel. If you write code to do SMP locking, mutexes and the like, and you compile for a single processor, nothing happens. That all goes away. If you compile for SMP, that stuff's absolutely critical. So write it in there. That way, if you do end up with an SMP processor for your next generation of the product, you can continue to reuse the code. That was what I wanted to cover to give you food for thought about working with embedded Linux. And at this point, I've got about 12 minutes left before I get beaten up, and I'd like some questions. Yes? Yes. In order, the way swap is routinely used by the kernel implies memory management. The embedded devices at the lower end, most things you do with Linux in embedded devices will have memory management, mainly because the programmers complain too much if you take it away from them. If you don't have memory management, you're running UC Linux. And if you're running UC Linux, you're in a sufficiently weird environment compared to what you normally used to, that you should only think of it as a migration path to Linux. So you can go into it, the assumption that you have memory management in embedded devices. Most chips these days have it. Most projects these days are built around memory management. The reason why you normally don't have swap is you don't have anywhere to swap to. You can swap to your flash chip, but you end up running out of programming cycles on it fairly quickly. Next. Yes?
You just mentioned it from interrupt to, well, copper, is it from user space program?
I'm sorry?
It's just that I use it so it's the.
From zero part.
Yeah, zero part if you generate the interrupt, but that interrupt is goes to user space?
No, it works the same. I'm going to repeat the question, I'm sorry. The question is how interrupts work on a serial port and how it affects user space. Interrupts do not go directly to user space. What happens is when the characters arrive in the device will try and generate an interrupt, but the interrupt may not be serviced for a while, so a few other characters will arrive. It'll attempt to generate interrupts fairly quickly. Those interrupts go to the kernel. The kernel manager has to respond to those interrupts and run the interrupt driver to collect the characters. Once there's characters in the buffer, if user space is waiting on the serial port, which it normally is, any program which is trying to communicate over the serial port generally spends a lot of time sitting in a select, waiting for characters to arrive. That select corresponds to a note in the device driver that user space would like to be notified when the buffer isn't empty anymore. So every time a character arrives, the hardware will store it and flag an interrupt. At some point, the processor will start processing that interrupt. It'll go out in the interrupt driver, it'll mark various things, and as it processes through the kernel, you will trigger user space. So you've caused an interrupt to manage it. You're running a bottom half to actually deal with the consequences to get to user space. and then you're doing a context switch to user space, just let user space know there's a character there. Then user space says, oh, I've returned from select, and the flag is set to say there's characters in the buffer. It's now, what's it going to do? It's going to do a read, which is a system call going back to the kernel to say, give me the data, that one or two characters that you got. Where the kernel will collect those and hand it back to user space. And you'll process that, and what you're going to do, you're going to immediately go into a select and wait for a few more characters. So a serial port is going to generate context switches if you can keep up at the rate of one interrupt and two context switches per character. Now, most devices can't keep up with that. So you'll end up with multiple characters turning up per that triplet. But the real consequence is that any serious use of a serial port, you just swamp the processor because of all those switches going on. Whether you're delivering 10 characters or one character, essentially you'll get as many context switches as you can get away with, which means what you really know is you don't have time for anything else. Whereas with USB, because USB only delivers characters back in 1 millisecond intervals, what the USB adapter you're using will collect characters until the millisecond elapses, will deliver it over the bus, and then at the end of the millisecond, an interrupt will tell the processor to check all the ongoing USB activities to see how they're getting on. So you're guaranteed to have your maximum of one interrupt for a millisecond's worth of traffic. And that interrupt is shared between you and other people. And by the time you get to tell user space's characters there, that select statement is guaranteed to tell you what's happened in at least 1 millisecond's worth of traffic. So you're inherently throttling down the amount of interaction that's going on just to deliver the data. Now, the downside of that is you have a latency. You can have 2 milliseconds of latency between sending a character to the device and that getting up to user space. But usually that kind of 2 millisecond of latency isn't normally going to hurt you.
The serial port is slow.
Yes. The other advantage, by the way, is that generally the serial ports that put in embedded devices have speed limits of, say, 100 kilobaud or something like that. But you can go out and buy USB serial adapters which can do a megabit. And if you plug that in, you've now got a megabit serial port on your device using nice big chunks of data going to user space. Whereas you only had 100 kilobits when you were trying to do it the other way. Okay.
Is there any advantage of getting rid of user-wise if you're dealing with a lot of kernel?
Yes. There's always advantages to staying in kernel at that point. The disadvantage is that you become the arbiter as to how much processing you're going to do before you hand off to somebody else. So what you end up doing is writing a little module that attaches to the serial port and does the same as user space does, of say, I'd like to be told when something arrives, and then you're triggering bottom half or a task load or, you know, pick your kernel version of the appropriate paradigm to get the work done.
So is that
no, actually, no, what happens is the other way around. Because USB abstracts all the communications, things are actually moving into user space and out of the kernel. Because there are so few context switches going on as part of USB transactions, you can actually afford to move a lot more of your USB processing up into user space. If you know you're only going to get a context switch anyway, once every millisecond, rather than make lots of kernel calls to find out what was happening, or do lots of processing in the kernel to deal with the device driver for that USB device, you may as well just have user space describe what it needs, make one kernel call to say, please do this, wait a millisecond to be told it was done. It doesn't actually cost you more or less. So USB tends to move things into user space, whereas things like serial that are very interactive tend to have to move the other way. Yes?
Also, to point out that even if the interrupts never have to get to user space, having the kernel have to interrupt whatever it's doing frequently can kill your performance. Your example of the network card, where the kernel network driver gets swamped just deciding that they can ignore the packet, none of that traffic ever got to user space because that interrupt was still killed.
Yes, the comment was that just the interrupts themselves are expensive enough on smaller embedded devices that plugging in a network card and not processing the packets, just turning on the interrupts and allowing the network card to generate an interrupt every time a packet arrives, can generate enough interrupts to kill the device without even actually looking at the packets.
That's why we should not listen to a network card.
That's right. And it's actually an important point in that. You should only listen to the network very carefully. If you're looking at a little embedded devices and somebody proudly says, our embedded device has 10 megabit Ethernet on it, 10 megabit should be considered a reason for panic And just go and read the spec, because usually when the devices say they're 10 megabit capable, what that usually means is they don't actually have a MAC recognition in hardware. The 10 megabit ones normally just leave the packet in memory and generate an interrupt to ask the processor to go and look at the packet to decide whether it's fit or not. You actually get all the packets as though you've taken the interface promiscuous. That's exciting if you're on a slow processor. There, suddenly the concept of a switch versus a hub becomes very, very important to you. And it's a terrible thing, because you can end up with people designing things around processors where essentially plugging it into a hub next to a Windows machine, the device is dead. And it's embarrassing, because customers won't want to buy that. The other thing you can have is people out there where it's a 100 megabit interface and it does do MAC checking, so you're thinking, oh good, I don't have this flooding problem. But what that means is somebody, all the broadcast packets get through. And it's a 100 megabit interface, so it's great. You can plug it into any switch and everything works great. With a 100 megabit chip, you have to ask yourself is how fast is the bus between the chip and the processor? And if the chip writes to memory and the processor has to read memory, that's two transactions per byte, so the device to write and the processor to read it. If you have a memory bus that's running at, oh, I don't know, let's say 30 megabytes per second, okay, and you plug it into a fast Ethernet, which remember is 12 megabytes per second from the chip to the memory, and another 12 megabytes from the memory to the processor, that leaves you with 6 megabytes per second for the processor to do everything else, including, by the way, make mention to the guy at the other end, would he please shut up? And that's the ones where you take a device which is 100 megabit capable and you plug it into the network and the Windows broadcast traffic takes the device off. All it's trying to do is to realize that actually these are all NMB search packets and they're not for it. But just making that decision is loading the device down. Yes, at the back. I'm sorry, I only caught half of that. Yes? Yes. The device pooling makes a huge difference for the interrupts. Because what you can configure, the device driver can configure the device to collect the stuff, leave it in memory, and I'll get around to it sometime. At which point, all of those context switches get consolidated down into one very small, occasional processing that does it in bulk. It makes a huge difference for that case, and that's why 100 megabit Ethernet cards, the real ones that can run sustained at those speeds, work that way. And gigabit cards have to, otherwise you just kill the system. When you start talking about the memory bandwidth one, it really doesn't help you very much, because you've already taken up the memory bandwidth just storing the packets. That's the memory bandwidth kills you even before you hit the interrupt. So that's the on the ten. The it depends which problem you're worrying about, really. Yes.
What is more popular, shared library or static library?
Which is more popular, shared libraries and static libraries? Well, the advantage of shared libraries is the fact you can kick them out of memory when you don't need them. This is not to be sniffed at when shared libraries are measured in whole percents of your system memory. Getting back 1% of your system memory, it's well worth kicking a shared library out. The other advantage of a shared library is the fact that they are shared. As soon as you can convince yourself that even a library will even ever be used by two clients at the same time, it's worth sharing it. Now, there are performance hits associated with shared libraries, but by the time you modularize things enough that sharing is benefiting you, sharing is the right way to go. To give you some idea, one of the reasons why UC Linux is a nightmare to work with is the fact it doesn't have shared libraries. For a shared library to work, it has to be put in memory and then put in memory where everybody can see it and link to it. The problem is you can't link to a shared library consistently when the library is in the same place for everybody, but I can't have a copy of it, because it just doesn't match up to where I need for dynamic linking. So as a result, a Hello World program might be 5% of your system memory, just by the time you've linked the stuff necessary to print Hello World. And so the biggest impact on UC Linux systems is the fact that you cannot have many processes. And suddenly you're going, well, that's just destroyed half the point of running Linux, is I can't just use lots of processes to do the job. And yes, that is in fact what happens, is you end up writing C programs to do three things that need to happen at the same time, because otherwise you have to run three programs at once, you can't afford the memory. Now, there's a workaround for that, and I'm going to mention it now so you all know about it, and then you can run away kicking and screaming. What you can do with UC Linux is build all your libraries as though they're static, and then you do something really sneaky. You link them all to the kernel. And then you find out where they ended up in the kernel. Remember, you don't have any memory protection, and you can make subroutine calls to the kernel anytime you want to. There's nothing to stop you doing that. And then you make a stub library, which is actually just a file, an object file, which says, if you're trying to call the function behind this symbol, it's over there and over in the kernel memory. Don't worry about it. Just call up there. And it works. The downside is that your whole build architecture that builds the kernel and links the kernel and then goes off and builds the libraries and links the libraries to the kernel and then realizes, wait a minute, I've got a loop in here somewhere, because remember, building embedded systems is a two-stage build. Suddenly, just writing the scripting to build the system starts looking like a nightmare. But the advantage is your Hello World program goes back to being really, really tiny. Okay. But for relatively static builds, that works fine. Now, the time is now 4 o'clock. My time is up. I'm very happy to take more questions, but I'd better do it outside the door.